Sarvata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanisantatami Bhagavad-gita Bhagavad-vaishini.
We're chapter 18, verse 42. We started 42 last time, and then we're going to do some more today. Right?
Shamo damas tapas shaucham. Shamo damas tapas shaucham. Shantirarjavamevacha. Shantirarjavamevacha. Jnanam vijnanam astikyam. Jnanam vijnanam astikyam. Brahmakarma subhavajam. Brahmakarma subhavajam. Shamaha damaha tapaha shaucham. Kshantihi arjavam eva cha. Jnanam vijnanam astikyam brahma karma subhavajam. I recall we went through shama, dhamma, and tapas, and some shaucham, right?
Yes.
Shaucham, kshantihi, and arjavam go together for adhikarna shuddhi. They all do, but when we do the shaucham, there's what we call the bahya shaucham, external cleanliness. Remember we talked a little bit about that external cleanliness, keeping your house clean, keeping your clothes clean. I always noticed in India, Swamiji always took two showers a day. One in the morning, and he would put on, of course this is India, you know, but put on a fresh dirty upper cloth in the morning, shower and fresh dirty and upper cloth, and then he'd have his nap in the afternoon, an hour or whatever the nap time he got, and then he would have a shower and put on a fresh dirty and upper cloth. Always fresh clothes and always a clean environment, you know. And that's considered external shaucham. In India, that's very important, actually. Clean body, clean clothes. And it does make a difference. You know? It makes a difference to put on fresh, clean clothes. So that external shaucham, so it starts with the body, the clothes, and then your environment. And probably all of us know, I mean, I certainly know, when my house is neat and clean, and my drawers are also emptied of junk, it makes a difference. You know, if your closets are clean, even if your doors are shut, but they're a mess, it makes a difference. So if you go through and get into the habit of that, keeping your environment clean and beautiful, it affects your mind, right? It's both, it's always the inner affects the outer and the outer affects the inner. It's a beautiful thing to understand. So if you're having trouble internally, clean your house. Take a shower, put on fresh clothes and clean your house. But these things matter. You know, it's a beautiful thing to understand. That's bahya shaucham, is taking care of this external. But antara shaucham is internal. And the mind also, we have to keep clean, you know. And part of that keeping clean has to do with looking at all the different types of reactions, negative reactions. Positive reactions are fine. There's joy to everybody. Your positive reactions are a joy to you, and they're a joy to everybody else. They're shaucham, you know, ananda. You know, like love and compassion and kindness and warmth and welcoming. Everybody loves, if you have these emotions, you feel good and everybody feels good. So that's Shaochim. So in those kind of that kind of welcoming abaya, I like for myself, for me just the word abaya is enough. Abaya means that freedom from fear. That Shaochim means freedom from fear is I'm not afraid. Let me not be afraid of you. Let me not be afraid of any being. Because what it means when I'm afraid of any being, I am pushing them away. Because it's just usually not about physical violence. That comes up in one's life not very often. Right? It's not really about physical violence. It's about fear of your own suffering or your own dukkha or your own unhappiness. And I'm afraid of you. I have fear of you because somehow I think that you're going to take my security or my well-being or my shanti away. So when I have that vow of abhayam, whenever I feel that way, when I'm pushing away, that becomes a sadhana. The sadhana is like cleaning your house, right? I need to, there's something that I need to do internally with my mind, you know, because the way that it's feeling is something that I want, that's what we use shaochim, is something that I want to clean. I want my mind to be free. I want it to be light. I want it to be sattvic. I want it to reflect my own nature. I think that's a nice way to say it. I want my mind to reflect the nature of the conscious being that I am. So that the being, conscious being that I am, is not illumining something that is not in harmony or resonate with my own nature. And so we look at that when my own nature is not in harmony with who I am. The word we have for that is mulla. It's mulla. Mulla means an impurity, like it's dirty. Mulla like is dust and dirt. So that's mulla. I want to be nirmala. Nirmala is actually a name, an Indian name. Some women are often named nirmala, free from any impurity. But internally, what that freedom from impurity means is that by my mind, the nature of my mind is in harmony and resonates with my being. And so that's shaochim. So when my mind is not like that, then I bring in some of my knowledge and my tools, my toolkit. Yeah? Like, for instance, Pratipaksha Bhavana. If I'm reacting to somebody, I bring in Pratipaksha Bhavana, which means, you know, everybody remember Pratipaksha Bhavana, where the paksha means a wing of a bird, is a paksha. Pratipaksha is the other wing, right? And so say you have an emotion which is hurtful to you in reference to another person, you want to bring in that other wing. Like, this emotion is hurtful to me. What emotion toward you would not be hurtful? That's the other side. And so if I'm suffering from this emotion, let me practice replacing it with this other emotion. Almost like just like a sadhana. Swamiji jokes, fake it till you make it. We joke like that, but actually that's not what it is. It's not fake it till you make it. It's this mulla is there in my mind, which is not what I value. It's not my value. This is my value. So let me bring in this. Even though this negative value has been generated, this is not what I want to own. I would want to be like this. So let me bring in that value. You know, we say fake it till you make it because that's not the value that wants to be there. Right? I want this. The mind has a tendency to want this other negative, hurtful value. It's not even a value, this hurtful emotion. That's what it's working toward. You're saying, no, let's try this one. Let's try this one. But this is the one that you're having to replace. This is the one that wants to be there. And so you feel like the phony bringing in this other one, but it's not that. It's that you're trying on another one for size, you know? the one that you value. So it's actually that pretty picture above it, thousands of years old. It's literally thousands of years old. It stood the test of time. And what it means is that you don't have to be the subject to all of these negative emotions that may be arising for one reason or another. You don't have to be overwhelmed by them. There are ways to work with these, you know, in order to transform them. But that requires commitment and consciousness. So shaochim, externally, initially, if your house is always dirty, it requires some commitment and consciousness to decide, I'm going to keep my house clean. Or I'm going to keep my body clean. It's a commitment because you're not doing it. So you make a commitment to do it. It's the same as you become conscious of attitudes and ways of being in your mind, of your mind that maybe you haven't even noticed before, you're just being that way and you don't even think about it. But then you start to think about it, you start to become aware of it. And as you become aware of it, then you want to bring about a change because it's a behavior that you no longer value. And so then that takes work, initially, because the mind has been naturally creating these type of negative emotions for many, many different reasons. Or childhood reasons, there's all kinds of reasons. But now that you become aware of it, there's certain methods that we have to transform those emotions. And you look at that as shaochim, as internal. Antara means internal, where I do that work. And it's actually very gratifying, and it's not that hard. Once you make yourself do it. The hard thing is that often the emotion is such that you feel there's a lot of, when say you have a negative emotion, like a negative emotion towards somebody, that negative emotion generates a web of other negative emotions that try to keep that emotion in place. It's almost like a logical system builds up around that negative emotion that justifies keeping that emotion in place. Like, for instance, that person did such and such and such and such. I hate that person because they did this and this and this and this, and they hurt me in this way and this way and this way, and they don't deserve for me to like them. They need to be punished. Okay. Now, all of this network, this is a spider web around an emotion that's generated, right? An emotion has been generated because the two of you, separate, just another person, the two people have come together in such a way that this negative emotion has been produced, right? It's a product. Negative emotion is a product. And then since it's hurtful, you know, we want to strike out at the person who's hurt us. We're actually, that's not what's happened at all. What's really happened is that this situation of these two people have come together, both of which have intricate and multidimensional cause-effect relationships that have gone on and on and on and on and on into the past that have generated this particular situation, which has generated this pain, right? And then both people, and this is also what we often don't realize, both people in whatever the situation are suffering that pain. This is another thing we don't know. You know, if Jung discovered this, he talks about it in a beautiful way, in fact, in his book called Answer to Job, where the one who's the perpetrator of the pain, causing the pain, is suffering the pain that they're causing. It's very interesting. You think that you're causing the pain in the other person, but you're actually causing the pain in yourself, so both of you are having the pain. Yeah. Yeah. And then we're really angry that we have that pain, that person is gone. Yeah. And so at some point, we have to learn about all of this, because it has to be worth it to you to sacrifice all of your justifications for the pain that you're suffering. Because you have to realize, whatever the justification, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever it is, whoever's done what, I'm the one who's suffering. And so once I can understand, I am the one who's suffering, and I would like to be free from suffering, then I become willing to do this work. You know? But there's a lot that goes on in my own buddhi to actually become willing to do the work to give up my suffering and the causes of my suffering. So there's a lot of consciousness involved around that. The wonderful thing is that the more I do it, the more I learn how to do it, and the more I do it, the more I do it. And the reason that is because it is so enjoyable, it is so freeing to give up that pain. It is so very freeing, and it's so easy once I start that process. But starting the process can be really hard. I've always told this story, I don't know how many times, of that woman when I was about 32 or so, that, you know, she was such a huge problem for me. She's such a problem, you know. And I couldn't even be in the same room with her. She just made me miserable, you know. And I used to tell Swamiji about it because it was a problem for me. I didn't know how to handle it. Yeah? And he told me, just go up and say hi. And go, don't do anything more. Just go up and say hi. And walk away. That's all. You know? And I'd come back and say, I just can't. No, I can't. And finally, you know, for 7 days of this, I made myself do it. Stupid. Just go up and say hi. Okay, so I had to force myself to do it. You know? But when I did it, I was totally released of that pain. Like that. It was so shocking. And then later it would come back. But that was so powerful. It was so powerful. It was such a powerful lesson that I learned that the next time it wasn't that hard. Because of the power of the huge release from doing that one positive, simple little act. So I did it again and again. And after I'd done that 3 or 4 times on the same person, then it was just a non-issue. But it wasn't just a non-issue for that person, my relationship with that person. It became what I do if I feel something like that. It became a very powerful sadhana that I now had some ownership of. Yeah. But before, you have to reap the results of these things. That's what I'm saying. I reaped the result of it. And then it became something that was so beautiful, so amazing, that it was worth it to do it again and again. And then it became something that was not a big deal. I didn't have to wait 3 days of forcing myself to do this thing that should be so simple, but it's not. I mean, I know it. I know it's not. That we develop a whole system of logic around it and blame, and they're causing me pain, they're causing me pain. Well, actually, they're not causing me pain. You are causing me pain. You are causing me pain. One way to understand that is there are so many people that you run into in the world that do mean things, but you don't feel victimized by them. You know? They could be mean or doing this or that, but it's not a problem for you. You know? But then this one person is doing some mean thing, according to you, is a problem. And it's because of the way that you receive their behavior. Mm-hmm. Swamiji used to always tell me, because and this was hard for me, but he used to always tell me, quit letting everybody inside. Don't let them inside. And, you know, for years I would think, What does he mean by that? What does he mean? Don't let them inside. What do you, now it's the most obvious thing in the world. But for years, it really wasn't obvious. What does he mean to not let them inside? Well, think of it like this. Say somebody has an emotion. They have an emotional distress, or they're angry at you, or they hate you, or they're jealous of you, or something is going on. Bad vibing you, it's directed towards you. If it's not directed towards you, then you know the person is bad vibing somebody, but it's not directed to you, so it doesn't bother you. But what happens is when somebody's bad vibing you, or directing their anger at you, or whatever it is, they're having a problem with you, okay? But why are you taking them inside? Why are you taking their problem inside? Why can't you just be present to their problem and do what you can to help? And if you can't do anything, you can't do anything. But why do you take them inside? That's what he meant. It's like you swallow the whole issue into your own emotional self, right? The problem that they're having, you receive. If they hate you, you become the one who's hated. Okay, they hate you, so they're feeling all this hatred, but because they're feeling the hatred, now you're also feeling the hatred. You're taking their hatred inside. Or they're jealous of you, so you're taking the pain of their jealousy that they're feeling from their jealousy, you're taking that inside. So you're taking them inside. So Swamiji would always say, keep everybody outside. Another thing he'd say, and these are just ways of saying the same thing, give people, of course he was telling me all of this because I had a hard time doing it. That's why I remember all of these things. You know? Give people the space to be. Let them be. They have a right to be. Let them be as they are. You know? But you know what? It's once you can do that, that's an easy thing. But I remember for a very long time not only not being able to do that, but not even understanding what he meant. Right? And so you can't take these things for granted, you know. But you have to think about them. You have to apply yourself to them. But even to apply yourself, you have to have a value. You have to have a value to do it. But to have a value to do it, something is a vairagya, a dispassion. It's a vairagya that has to take place where you understand that, gee, it is not worth it to me to be hurt or upset. It's not worth it to be involved in the world in that way. And I want to change it. I don't want to be like that. No matter how justified, it doesn't make any difference. I don't care about that anymore. I don't want to carry this suffering. So this is that shaucham. Swamiji spends a lot of time on this inner shaucham and all of these scrubbing techniques, you know, all the wash rags and everything that we have to use internally to release our mind of these kind of reactions. And all of this is in light of my knowledge. Bhagavad Gita, all of these texts, the whole Vedanta is about the source of ananda being yourself. There is no external source of ananda. There is no external source of love. There's a mind that becomes quiet so that the natural wholeness of your being reflects in that shanti in a way that we name as the different types of positive emotions like love and compassion and kindness and joy, you know, and pleasure and happiness. These are just words. They're words that are pointing to the positive spectrum of emotion. But the positive spectrum of emotion that we experience are all only a variety of shantavrittis. That's all they are, that we've given names to. And the shanta vrittis are the type of vrittis that don't conflict. They're subtly different. You know, there's subtle differences in them, but they don't conflict with my own being. So I'm totally comfortable when those vrittis are there. right? The negative spectrum are the vrittis that are brought about by stress and tension, where there's stress in the mind of one form or another, and we have a lot of names for those levels of stress, like dislike, agitation, hatred, jealousy, bitterness, etc. Whatever words we have, we've named them all, right? But all they are different levels of stress in the mind. Once I start to understand that, why do I want those? Why do I want that stress in the mind? Why do I want the world to even be able to bring that stress about? What do I get out of that? I get nothing out of it except the negative spectrum of stressful emotions, of stressful vrittis that I've named in all of these ways. And all of these ways are things that I don't want. At this spectrum, I don't want. And so why am, when I am the ananda, the nature of your very being is the ananda, is love, is wholeness, is that sacred self, why doesn't my mind, you know, just enjoy my being? And then let the world be Ishvara. This is Ishvara, after all. Just keep my mind in the... Why don't I just keep my mind here in the present with Ishvara? And this is the whole... So much of this chapter now is moving into exactly what I'm saying now. Why don't I just keep my mind here in the present with Ishvara, rooted in the refuge of my own being? Refuge means the very ananda or fullness of my own being. Why am I getting engaged in the world in a way that creates pain for myself and others? Because there's no reason. Maybe there would be a reason, you could say, if in reality the ananda or the love that I'm seeking actually existed out here somewhere, and now there's a war for me to get it because it is not okay for me not to have love and wholeness. It's absolutely not okay. I must have wholeness. I must have love. Why? Because, really, because it's my own swarup, it's my own nature. That's why I have to have it. So if somehow I projected it out here, then I'm going to go try to find myself out here somehow. But what about when I know that the ananda or the fullness, everything that I seek is really my own nature? And as I start to know that, this getting engaged in samsara in this way that creates so much pain and suffering for myself and others, why do I do it? Well, that question becomes very real. You know? But for a long time, that question is not real. And I don't take that question seriously. But there comes a time when I do take that question seriously, because it makes no sense at all. When I actually understand, you know, what my own nature is. And so as I understand that, and these sadhanas become real to me and important because I want to be with myself. You know? Why should my mind suffer? It's not necessary. So it has this habitual ignorance. Let me just help it. Let me help my mind. And let me help the unconscious parts and free them. Then this kshanti is the shasham. Then kshanti comes. Kshanti means accommodation. Let me accommodate the world as Ishvara. Let me accommodate you as Ishvara. Let me accommodate my little ones as Ishvara. Accommodation to me, that kshanti has to do, is that welcoming. You know, welcoming. Like, say a person is angry and hateful toward me. Can I welcome them? Because what happens if I'm welcoming? What happens to me? This is the beautiful thing. Say somebody is jealous of you or hateful for you or toward you or whatever. And say your attitude toward them is to welcome them. You know, means internally. It's not, oh, welcome, welcome. I don't mean that. I mean internally, you welcome them. Oh, it's like in your mind you feel, okay, you can be with me, it's fine. What happens to yourself when you do that? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Because nothing can touch your being. So nothing happens to yourself. What happens to your mind? Nothing. It's just that your mind doesn't get stressed in that situation. What happens to the other person's mind? Well, their mind relaxes also, because just by law, it will relax also, because what every being wants and needs is only to be welcomed. It's only love, that's all. Because they're also trying to get back to their own self. That's why they're having such a hard time. That's why they're so angry and so bitter and so hateful. Because somehow they think something has happened to take that away from them, and you're involved in it. That's all it is. It's just a big illusion. And so say, what if, just as a sadhana, you do that kshanti. So if somebody is, you know, trying to hurt you, you just welcome them, because yourself cannot be hurt. Once you realize the Atma can't be hurt, it's like trying to cut space with a knife. You know, knife, nothing happens. You know how Swamiji's talked about this about himself? He said, I'm just a screwless screw. You know, a screw that is stripped, is trying to tighten it, you know? You can't do it. So somebody's trying to push on him or take advantage of him or whatever it is. She says, I'm a screwless screw. Nothing is going to happen. You know? But see, the thing is, for all of this to become real for you, you have to recognize the fact of it, that nothing happens. That's why when we do like a contemplation, or we do a guided meditation, and you sit with your own presence, and you see, nothing happens, nothing is happening to you, nothing can happen. Nothing can happen. Just by your nature, your mind can't change yourself, your actions can't change yourself, another person can't change yourself, your moods, emotions can't change yourself. You are the one who's there. It's a different order of reality. It's like the difference between the rope and the snake. No matter what that snake does, it's not going to touch the rope. And no matter what my mind does or what the world does, it's impossible for it to touch or change me. But you have to recognize that. It's not just a thought. You have to recognize that inviolate nature of yourself and how sacred it is. That's why sometimes when we do this, like imagine Dakshinamurti sitting in that beautiful posture, you know, with that gentle eyes and that gentle smile. That's Shastric. Every single, the exact way that smile is, the exact way the eyes are closed, the exact posture is all written down exactly. It's very specific. So that when they actually make that murti, and then the eyes and all of that, it's all completely Shastric, because that murti is a symbol, an image for your being. It's an image for, like if I were to, it's impossible to really contain who you are with words. Like even if I say, you are all Shanti, you know, you're a Sangha, you're not, there's no attachment. These are just words, right? But the words, all of these words together are pointing to you. And the murti also is pointing to you. And so when you look at the murti, like the Dakshinamurti in our temple, and then you just let yourself assume that form and assume that facial expression, it's very powerful. Because that facial expression is kind of just perfect. It's just perfect to fit for the Atma, for yourself. It's a perfect fit for yourself. So you can just take on that very gentle smile, very gentle eyes closed, body relaxed, and then notice the one who's indwelling. You. Yourself is the one who's indwelling this body. What is that like? Why that gentle smile? And that gentle smile, just like a word, like peace, Shanti Ananda points to you, you let that gentle smile point to your nature. You see what I mean? And what's so beautiful about it is that, you know, your body and the position of your body and the relaxation of your body and the expression on your face does affect the mind and brings the mind into kind of a state of being that resonates with yourself. And so that's why it's powerful. Sometimes, you know, in as a therapist, we can tell our clients, you just walk around with a big smile on your face for a while. Make yourself smile. And one of my friends who is doing this, it's not a client, one friend, she was told to do this. And the therapist told her, put a pencil in your mouth and bite on the pencil. Walk around with a pencil in your mouth.
Oh, to bring it up.
Yeah. Because you put a pencil, you know, and it makes your mouth, so you just walk around with it for a while with a pencil in your mouth. Okay. But it changes your chemistry. You know? It's just like you walk around with a big pouty face. Changes your chemistry. You know? So that, I mean, that's all funny, but it's true. So what I'm saying is, like, when we're doing a puja, and Dakshinamurti is there, or Jnaneshwari, or Shiva, or whatever the murti is, they're not just... They are evoking their very presence in terms of the way that their face is and the way the smile is, the way their body posture is evoking, you know.
Clint Eastwood.
It's evoking something in you. It's really beautiful, actually, to appreciate what that is. So anyway. So that shanti, accommodation, one more we'll do. Arjavam. Arjavam also is considered for antakarna shuddhi. Very important. It means being straight arrow, straightforward. What they mean? But what they mean by it is what you say should be true to what you're thinking, even though you don't necessarily ever say everything you think. But what you do say should be true to what you think. It shouldn't be a lie, you know. So what you say should be true to what you think. And what you do should be true to what you say. You say one thing and do another, you know. So there's an honesty there, a straightforwardness. And when that straightforwardness is there, there's a lot of relaxation that takes place in your mind because you're not crooked. Right. It's very stressful. People who lie, it's very stressful. You know, if you've ever done it before, which I'm sure most of us have done it, what happens is you can never remember who you told what. Lying is a really big problem. You have to have an excellent memory. Because it's a lie. It's a lie, so it never really happened, right? If it happened, then you have something to hook those words onto. You have a reality to hook them onto. But if you're lying, you don't have anything to hook it onto. You know? And so then, it's a very, very difficult, very complex problem. Mm-hmm. You know? People think they can get away with lying, but you actually create a mess for yourself. So this arjavam, that straightforwardness, you know, what you see is what you get. And you never have to worry about it. Don't have to worry about yourself. Because you're straightforward, you know. And so that's considered, for shanti, peace of mind, that arjavam is considered very, very important. You know. Remember, you think many, many, many things. You're not going to say everything you think, nor should you. Because vaktapas means... Whatever I say, it should be true, but it should also be beneficial, useful, and it should also be pleasing. Otherwise, I shouldn't say it. What right do I have to say that unless I'm somebody's teacher or I'm their parent? Those are the two exceptions. But so you may think a lot of things that you don't say because they're not hit them, they're not beneficial, and they're not paying, they're not loving, they're not kind. So those things you don't say. But that's not the point. The point is that what you do say, it should be true. To what you think, should be true. And what you do should be true to what you say. You say you do one thing and then you do another. No. There has to be a straight... Arjipa means a straight line, not crooked. And so that's considered really important. So, shamaha, dhammaha, tapaha, shaucham, kshantihi, arjipam, evacha. So these are qualities. These are the only qualities he's giving here for a brahmana, but they're all-encompassing, really. And then the other qualities that we'll do next time, jnanam, they're not qualities exactly, jnanam, vijnanam, asticam. That has to do with really assimilation of dharma and assimilation of knowledge and shraddha. Not the astika buddhi is the buddhi that has shraddha in the Vedas, in the Acharya, in the Upanishads, in the teaching. So that I'm actually contained by that dharma because I have shraddha in it. Shraddha means that, to me, this is the truth. In terms of the Vedanta, it would be the astika buddhi. Having shraddha would mean to for my guru and the teaching, you know. I have shraddha that this is the truth pending my understanding. Otherwise, what am I doing? You won't be here. Without that shraddha, you won't be here. You can't. Why would you be? So shraddha is considered a great punya, actually. So, but it extends here, the teacher-guru-teacher relationship, guru-seisha relationship they're talking about. They're also talking about just dharma itself, that Vedic container, the container of dharma. Why do you believe in dharma? Why do you have shraddha in dharma? Why do you have shraddha in Ishwara? And so that becomes a topic here. So to stop. I did a long meditation today, so.
Yeah, sacred.
Swasti Pajabhya Paripalinam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashiva Mastinityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yangsho Parahitaha Brahmanasantu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschid dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
So, if you're in the middle of something where someone's attacking you, like I had a phone call last night from someone that this person just criticized me for like 10-15 minutes in the name of kindness, And I felt awful. I felt awful even into today. I mean, I ended up staying up late and I was all upset. I don't want to have anything more to do with this person. You know, I'm going to have to be careful how to arrange that. But at the same time, you know, clearly I allowed it in. Mm-hmm. I didn't keep them outside. I didn't do that thing. And it's so good to hear this as a reminder. So, I mean, I think I'm starting to understand what it means after having heard it a lot of times. But how to implement it, that's a whole nother...
I think, you know...
Especially when you're in the middle of it. And then even after, if you're all upset and you're just...
Exactly. Like, I think it takes quite a bit of time before it becomes natural while it's happening. Before, during, and after. That's like means you've become a master of that particular skill. Right? So you don't start out that way. Often what happens is you're totally hurt and they've taken it in completely and it's all awful. And then it's over. And then you can sit with yourself and first welcome the one who's hurt, that part of you that's hurt. Just totally welcome it and be with it. And then once you can do that, then you can welcome the one who's caused the hurt. It's hard to bypass around the one that is hurt, you, the part of you that's hurt, to welcome the other part. There comes a time when you're not really very hurt, and so you can just welcome the other part. But if you're really hurt, then you want to welcome that one first. And why I say welcoming, because the nature of yourself is ananda, is love. So when the buddhi is welcoming the hurt part, which we give to the manas, like it's welcoming the hurt part, then the buddhi becomes relaxed and it becomes a voice for the self. Right? Because it's as the buddhi relaxes welcoming, then it becomes loving by nature. It's not tense. And so it can welcome the one that's hurt. It's differentiated the one that's hurt in that welcoming. And then that one, the one who's hurt, because the buddhi is relaxing, that affects the manas, which also relaxes as the buddhi relaxes. And so the hurt dissipates quite a bit in the part of you that is hurt. And so once that is taken care of, then you can practice as almost like a sadhana, bringing in this hurtful person who triggers you, say, a triggering person, and you just bring in their image, you know, and there's different things you can do with that image. One is to just be with that image and welcome it, and then when you do that, if this is possible, when you do that, then what happens is that the buddhi again is not constricted, you know, in the presence of that image. And then what happens is the awful feelings that are associated with that image dissipate as the buddhi relaxes, because the awful feelings are really only caused by the constriction of the buddhi. That's what causes that whole negative spectrum. It's just stress in the mind. And we have a lot of different names for it. You know, like stress that's really bad, where there's a lot of tension in the mind. You can say, you know, that's like, becomes like a depression. Because the ananda of the self can't even get through. The mind is so, you know, constricted. That's one way to think about it. And so you get to kind of have a mastery of being able to relax your mind in different challenging situations.
It's like the welcoming and that work together.
Yes.
It's not so much setting up a shield.
No, it's not.
Let them in. It's staying relaxed in the middle of the
mm-hmm.
thing by using welcoming.
By using welcoming. Exactly.
But the thing is that if they're always there taking away your well-being or taking away.
Well, they aren't really. That's the illusion.
Well, criticism is like that. It takes you away from.
When you let it inside, we're so used to letting it inside. Like it's like. We tend to respond to some criticism or something as though somebody shot an arrow and it went right into our heart.
Yeah.
Right? But actually there's no physical arrow being shot. And so it's kind of like
maybe it's like Aikido or something, you know, where this thing is being thrown at you, but you just receive it. When you're receiving it, and I'm talking about on the subtle plane, not the physical plane, but when you're receiving it, there's no tension. Let them, they have the tension. Why do you have to take it on? But that requires some practice, because we're not used to that. We're used to meeting stress with stress, anger with anger, you know, hurt with hurt. So we immediately get totally, we take it into ourselves, and then we have that person inside who's hurting us, so the two of us are there inside walking around, you know, together.
So what's the baby step in this process?
I think the first step is, first of all, to know that probably initially you do take them inside. Right? and accept that.
To see that.
But then after the fact is to be able to sit with yourself and sit with that situation and welcome yourself, that's comfort yourself, the one who's hurt, by just welcoming. Say, it's okay, you can be with me. And just kind of relaxing. And as you relax, the hurt dissipates. And then you can start welcoming that image. Or you can sit with that image and have a dialogue. You know, we have many different things that we do. But one is to, easiest one is to work on that welcoming, even though sometimes it doesn't work, and then you have to do more, like have that inner dialogue. But always remember to welcome yourself first.
Yeah.
It's like put you know, the airplane, you put your mask on first before you put on the mask of your children. You have to take care of yourself first, otherwise you won't be able to do it.
Well, that's what's so dangerous about criticism, is because it's pushing you away. You know, it's not welcoming.
The criticism isn't welcoming, but how do you receive the criticism? You know? How do you receive it? If you're taking it like the person...
Well, if it hurts, it hit the target.
It hurts because because of the way you're responding to it. But you're used to responding to criticism in that way. So which is true, we're not usually used to respond... We're used to responding to criticism in a defensive way.
It's frightening to relax, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the opposite of the instinct.
It's the opposite.
That's like Pratipraksha-bhavana.
Pratipraksha-bhavana. That's why you probably can't do it at first. That's why at first, and after it's over and that person's out of the room or something, then you sit with yourself. And you welcome the one who feels in you who feels hurt, not the other guy, you know. And then when you welcome the one who's feeling hurt, so that person's okay. Then you have the strength to be able to accommodate that guy.
I don't know if this is exactly relevant, but Marshall Rosenberg has this really beautiful thing that he says. He recommends, or he suggests, never listen to what someone is thinking, listen to what they're feeling.
That's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's Larry Jaffe, who was a Jungian analyst, he said something, I'm trying to think of the word, something similar to that that I really loved. I'll have to look it up. It's something like... your presence is so loud I can't hear what you're saying. But it's a little bit similar, right?
Yeah.
Actually, that's really profound, because usually what they're saying is defensive to what they're actually feeling. So if you're listening to what they're feeling, it's usually the one who's being defended by the attack, you know? In psychology, would say, like, you know, understand what I mean? God, I really.
So
that.
Michael was
What's that guy's name?
Marshall Rosenberg.
Rosenberg.
Nonviolent communication.
Oh, nonviolent communication. Oh.
Do you have the book? I'll give you one.
Okay, I'd like to have one.
He's
yeah.
incredible.
Yeah.
He just died like last
did
year.
Did he?
Did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, bring me that book. You have an extra one?
I have one in my car.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Super. You do a lot of nonviolent communication at the school.
Ah.
Yeah.
Was it due to illness or accident?
I never heard why.
Some of these things, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done around some of these things. They're so profound.
Mm-hmm.
What's nice about Vedanta is it takes it all the way to the source.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it gives you all the way to the source why these things work, you know. But these things work so beautifully.
Yeah, I think he did take it pretty far.
Yeah.
Toward
yeah. that. Yeah. Yeah, I'd really like to see that book.
There are also a lot of, seminars and workshops
that he's done
that were videotaped.
Yeah.
That
are
you
they
can
on YouTube?
Watch on YouTube or listen to on YouTube.
Yeah.
So I really liked reading the book.
Yeah.
And then
watching the
in the morning, like if I'm stretching or something, just
yeah.
have it playing and try to listen to it while I'm
yeah.
stretching and sort of reinforce
yeah.
what I read and learned from reading. And he adds on it. And
yeah.
it's really great.
Yeah, that's
he's
beautiful.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It's amazing. And then, you know, we use that also for a lot of diversity work. So it's beautiful to know these things.
So one thing he shares, which I find is really profound, instead of saying, you did this, he says, I observed, he says, express what you notice the other person is doing, and then take responsibility, like what you were saying, for the story. So you do something and I say, well, I observed that you were doing that and the story that I'm running is this and this and this.
Yeah.
And in that way you can really kind of sit with it. Like, it's like, you know, you're just really part of the internal process. You put yourself, instead of putting it outside of you, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, it seems like what you're saying in a way, I was just reflecting about it, it seems like that's already so, like with core issues that really push your buttons, that's such an advanced level already that you can fully assimilate your own experience, you know, especially in the moment.
Yeah, that's in the moment, it means you've practiced this for a while.
That's already like mastery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what's wrong with that? These are the things we should be practicing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because they totally resonate with our knowledge.
Yeah.
That becomes fun, you know. It's like learning a martial art or something. It's something that you take seriously and you do to develop that kind of mastery that is totally in line with who you actually are. You know, but you have to be kind of excited about it, like it's
internal martial art.
Yeah, Swamiji, you know, he loved all this stuff. He took his mind, the mastery of his mind, very seriously, and he really enjoyed it also. Took it seriously. Like I've told you the story about when he had this book of matches, you know, and he had seen somebody light a match with one hand, like open the book with one hand and then bend down the match and go like that. And so Swamiji was playing around with this, trying to do it, and the whole book of matches blew up in his hand, you know. So he went like that. It startled him like that. And he thought, why did I get startled like that? You know? He didn't like that, that he got startled like that. And so he worked on it. He took that seriously. Why did I react like that? You know? He took his mind seriously. Because why not? You know, it's something, like say you have a dog. He's also used an example like this. You know? But you don't train your dog. You know, so that your dog doesn't get a chance really to behave, and then it just runs you all over the place. That's how my dog was when I had it. I had the most beautiful dog. His name was Willie. He was kind of a shepherd, German Shepherd mix. I could never train him at all. It was just hell. I loved him so much, but he was the most untrained. An untrainable dog.
And it just wrecked everything, really. It made it so impossible.
How old were you?
I was about 17 or 18, about 18. Total novice. Didn't know anything about it. And old Willie was wild as anything. You know? That wouldn't happen now.
You'd be tough.
Well, I think I would learn how to do it properly.
You could.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something about smiling.
Yeah.
Because when I go to Bali, everybody's always smiling there. And it's not like they're always happy or that they always mean it. But after I've been there year after year, I found that being grouchy and being angry was kind of embarrassing.
It was outside of the norm.
It was. And then I learned to smile along with them. And then when I would come back to this country, it would have a really good effect on my interactions with people.
That's true also. That's something that I don't know why it takes a long time to learn, but your own friendliness and happiness makes life so much better for you. You know, if you have a choice to be nice as opposed to mean, people respond nicely to that. Mm-hmm. And how do they respond when you're mean? Well, it's not very pleasant, right? It's horrible. So then you would think we would just learn, well, maybe it's a lot better just to be kind.
Well, how does that smile help in contemplation? Because it seems like it does. There's some the direct correlation there.
I think it's just the same idea. There's a mosquito. I think it's the same idea as how your breath and mind are related. Same thing, like if your mind is quiet, your breath is quiet. If your breath is quiet, your mind is quiet. So say your mind is upset, and then so you modulate your breathing, and that affects your mind. So it's the same, like smiling affects your mind. There's chemistry involved. Frowning, you know, like when you're really unhappy, your mind naturally takes on an unhappy face. When you're happy, your mind naturally takes on a happy face, right? So now what if you're unhappy and you decide, I'm unhappy, let me put on a happy face. Because the happy face is what goes along with a happy mind, and that changes my disposition because the two affect each other.
That's because
a lot of studies have been done on that, by the way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that there's a hormone that's released, I think it's called serafin. Smile.
Because in the images of these different yogis and the deities and the devatas, all of them are invariably smiling. You know, I mean, it's just outrageous.
Well, they're smiling. They have that gentle smile because because they're supposed to have that gentle smile on because they're showing your own nature. Right? It's an image of your own nature. We're stopping.
Oh, I was just getting good.
I know, but it's time. It's over.
I think I just missed the translation of one of the words.
Shanti is accommodation.